This is episode number 10. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Welcome to the Innovateology podcast, where it is all about unleashing the creative side to find those brilliant, disruptive ideas to validate and build innovative solutions to solve life's problems.
Hello, and welcome back to episode number 10. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is going to be a very insightful podcast. As you may have been following along with some of our other podcast episodes, our focus here at Innovateology has been to highlight those innovative ideas and solutions to solve life's challenges, as well as highlight the journey of the innovators who helped create those ideas and develop those solutions. For today's podcast, we have a very inspiring guest who is a true innovator, Glenna Crooks, PhD and CEO and founder of the company Sage My Life. She is also an author of two books that will be released soon, The Network Sage, Realize Your Network Superpower, and The Senior Sage, Aging Well in Place. The biggest question that we work to solve every day is where do we spend our energy and focus our priorities, or as I call it, the daily routine of managing chaos. Glenna has taken this a step beyond and taken a deep dive using her scientific background to understand how and why we connect with others to help us live better and succeed. Regardless of how much chaos we've got to manage, she's identified a way to think about our networks and manage them so we can live life fully and achieve goals that we want to set. Today, in this episode, we hope to answer the following questions. What inspired Glenna's continual reinvention of herself as an innovator? She worked in education, healthcare, and public policy. She was also an appointee of President Reagan, a Fortune 50 global vice president, and an entrepreneur global strategist, and now a tech startup founder. We also hope to answer what is Sage My Life? And when did the seed of this idea occur? How has Glenna navigated her innovation journey going from the idea to the actual Sage My Life company? Thank you so much, Glenna, for coming on our show today for Innovateology. So let's just jump right into these questions. So this is your eighth career. How did you reinvent yourself? And did this have anything to do with your early life?
Thanks for inviting me, Mary. It's really a pleasure to talk with you today. You know, I wish I could say that I had done it deliberately, but I didn't. In fact, I didn't have much of a plan for my life, or better put, probably I had plans, but I got derailed. Women in my generation really didn't have a lot of career options. If they were going to be in the workforce at all, it was to be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher, perhaps. I decided in about the fourth grade, after the first astronauts went up in space capsules, that that's what I wanted to do. I started studying math and physics in earnest at that point, but it didn't work out well for me socially. In fact, the only parent-teacher conference that was ever called on me was because I was competing against the boys in math, and the teachers didn't think that was an appropriate thing for a girl to do. In fact, by the time I was in the eighth grade, I was actually punished by not being allowed to sit for a qualifying exam for a district-wide math competition. Finally, in high school, my guidance counselor sat me down and said, "Girls just can't be astronauts, and by the way, you're not smart enough to go to college anyway." Now, I succeeded regardless. I persisted. My parents were good role models for me in that. And so I got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. I worked as a school psychologist, and I did some good things for kids in those years. I burned out, though. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went back to school. I got a PhD. And I would say that ever since then, I've really hit my stride. As it turns out, I have a talent for organizing chaos and solving complex problems, and that's what I've been doing ever since. So that's actually the sort of driver behind now all of the various careers that I have. No 2 days are the same, and I've been able to transition between sectors of the economy and between companies, between being an entrepreneur and now as a founder of a tech startup pretty easily because of that skill set.
Very, very interesting, all those transitions. So can you give us a favorite quote or source of inspiration?
It's Something that I read rarely recently, and I actually have it posted on my mirror, it says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. That comes from an African proverb, and in the book that I've written about Sage My Life, I talk about how you can actually do both. You don't have to choose between one and another if you build the right sort of networks around you.
That's a great quote. And so let's go a little bit deeper. What energizes you and how do you sustain your energy using your networks?
This is going to surprise people who know me, but I'm an introvert. Now, I'm really outgoing and I love people. I love to be with them. But it also says I need downtime. I really need quality time with me. And so because of what I've learned about networks and about me, thinking about me inside my networks over the last few years, what I've done is be much more careful about where I spend my energy. And in addition to that, I've been teaching people, especially in my social network, how I need downtime so that when the time comes that I say, hey, I'm having an introvert moment and I just need to leave the party and go home, they understand that I don't mean to be offensive. I just need that sort of personal downtime.
Very interesting, because I know a lot of the folks listening are probably introverts as well, too. I know I have that introvert tendency. So let's dive a little bit into the Sage and the Network Sage. How has living the life the Network Sage way enhanced your life?
Personally, it's helped me to be healthier and happier and far more successful with far less effort than I ever thought was possible. But more than that, I've been writing and teaching people about this, and I have such a great sense of satisfaction when I see how they use it and how they achieve their dreams, whatever those might be, whether it's to, you know, spend more time with their kids and focus on their parenting, or whether it's to be a community volunteer, or whether it's to go up the career ladder or grow their business. So when I see that, I am so enthused for them, and I never get tired of hearing their stories. It really is what, in part, fuels me to keep going.
Very interesting. So why did you see this need, and how did you validate that need or idea? And did this start in your corporate life, or was it a transition from the corporate world into this entrepreneur form? Can you take us back?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I didn't really find this need. It found me. I had already left the corporate world. I was working as a consultant, a strategist, with governments and businesses around the world in the healthcare sector who had seemingly unsolvable problems that they needed to address. Well, you know what it's like. You work long days with people. You have long dinners with people, another glass of wine, and they start letting their hair down. And many of these executives who were running major corporations, had important government jobs, started telling me how afraid they were about the future. They were concerned that maybe they didn't have the skills that they needed in order to really solve the problems they were addressing. They were concerned about their customers. They were concerned about their employees. And about, in the government case, the constituents that they served. They wanted to talk to somebody, and they picked me. After all, I'd been an advisor to them. I designed a one-day program, and what I did was ask a friend of mine, Jonathan Peck, who is a futurist. I thought it was important to have a man's perspective in the room, whether we were dealing with a woman or a man, to have both genders there. And what we did in one day was meet with one person, and we designed a strategic plan for their life for the next 4 quarters. Now, that was everything in their life, their personal life, their work life, their health life, everything. We laid it all out. We looked at how they could combine activities to get more bang for the buck, if you will, in the investments they made of their time and their energy. And we presented them then with this written plan. We didn't coach, by the way. It was just that one day. We thought that, you know, we do strategic plans for our businesses. Why not for our lives? We hypothesized that it would work, and it did. Not one person who started the day saying that they wanted to leave a job or a marriage or both did so. And they all went on to be dramatically more effective.
That's very interesting how you kind of focused in on that individual. So I'm curious, how did Sage start? And what was that first idea that popped into your head?
During the time that Jonathan and I were doing these one-day sessions, which at the time we called Best Edge, Working Your Best Edge, we were getting a little bogged down because both of us had other businesses to run. This was just a sideline for us. And I wanted to serve more people than just one at a time. And so I was looking for another way to do that. Now, one of the things most people don't know about me, and this is relevant to the story, is that I like action flicks and superheroes. So it was 2007, and I saw the trailer for the first Iron Man movie, became an instant fan of the movie. Well, while I was waiting for the movie to be released, I was also watching interviews with Robert Downey Jr., and in one of them, in a fashion magazine, he commented that he had a pit crew of people helping him out. He named his sensei, a yoga teacher, a psychiatrist, but he said, but you know, I need a pit crew. He said, I'm not a Model T, I'm a Ferrari, and it takes more of a pit crew to keep us on the road. Well, my first thought about that, I must have been in a snarky mood that day, was, hey, if you're a Ferrari, I am at least a Maserati. And you know what? You're right. It does take a pit crew. Who's mine? And how are they doing? And then finally, I started to worry. I thought, uh-oh, I'm in other people's pit crews. How am I doing? Now, after thinking about this for a while and starting to muse about whether this might be the replacement for Best Edge, I realized that I had actually looked at pit crews before, but only about my business. A consultant had suggested to me that I make a list of everybody I needed to manage in order to have my business, but I had never looked at my personal life. So what I did was put a piece of paper on the kitchen counter, and as people's names came to me, I wrote them down on the list. I quit at a point when I thought I was done. Turns out I wasn't. I forgot. But that list at that point I quit the first time was 139 people. I had no idea that's what it took to manage my personal life, 139 people. And I, by the way, have a relatively simple life because I don't have a spouse. So there's no in-laws or his friends or colleagues on my list. I don't have children. So there's no babysitters and teachers and coaches and orthodontists on my list. My mom is healthy. She didn't need me for anything at the time except love. My friends weren't having any crises at the time they needed me for. I didn't have a dog. I didn't even have a cat.
Wow. That is some amazing insight right there. So I can't even imagine that my life, how many people would need to support my life with two kids and a whole family if it was only 139 for a relatively simple life, as you phrased it. So what are some of those insights did you realize about yourself on this journey?
Yeah, I'll start with some about me, but then if you don't mind, I'm going to add some about other people because I think that's relevant as well. When you learn to be a network stage, you not only understand things about yourself, you understand a lot of things about others. So I learned a couple of things. First of all, I had no idea who was in my life and the impact that they were having on me for better or for worse. And that's true of every one of the hundreds of people that I've worked with on this since I began. Next, I never really thought about what mattered to me. In my company or when I was a government official, I was very careful to steward the resources of the government or the company, but I wasn't careful about my own. And by that, I don't just mean financial. I mean the time I had available. So I never really appreciated how much I valued my time and therefore how angry I was getting, kind of without realizing it, at hairdressers who would keep me waiting or doctors who would keep me waiting, or how much I disliked having to remind my accountant to get my taxes done by the tax date, or press my lawyer ahead to get my will revised before I went on an international trip. So this really helped me to clarify what I found important and what I needed from anybody who was helping me out, and especially when I was paying them. The next thing is I didn't have a language for describing the types of connections that I had with other people and how relatively important or unimportant they were. And as a result of that, I spent too much of my energy on people who were relatively unimportant. This doesn't mean I would be rude or mean to them. It's just that I was too patient and allowed them to take too much of my time, when in fact I had other priorities with people who were dearest to my heart or most important in my career, where I would have preferred to spend my time. The other thing is, I didn't realize how important I was. I didn't see my uniqueness in the way that I do now. Now that I see networks and the way they work, and now that I understand human history through the lens of the 500 generations that have preceded me since the dawn of civilization, what I realize is that I'm unique not just because of my genetics, but because of all of the life experiences that have been passed down to me. So I feel a real debt to all those people who came before me, not only in my family networks, but in all of my others. I feel a debt to the teachers I had and the teachers they had and the teachers they had going all the way back. And the same thing with anybody who provides me with healthcare or, frankly, the architecture of the building that I live in. I'm here because of them. And so I feel a need to not just thank them, but to be as best as I can in this world because of the sacrifices that they made that allow me to be here. In addition to that, I also see the future. And I know that if I take all that's been given to me and I use it well, I will bless every generation that comes after me. I mean, whether they're genetically related to me, since I don't have kids, they won't be, except for cousins and aunts, you know, and nieces and nephews and so on. But I kind of see the whole world as an opportunity for me to bless in the future, and so I want to do that.
I really like how you're giving back. That's a very important part of kind of identifying how you'll give back. But what are some of those trends that you have seen? Which gender has the most connections and manages the most connections? Why is that? And how many connections can we truly manage?
Sir Robin Dunbar is an evolutionary psychologist. He says we can manage only 150 connections well. He cites a lot of data, not only historical records, but also some contemporary examples. You know, for example, people who send holiday cards tend to send cards to, I think, around 68 households with a total of 150 people in them. Now we know that academics and professionals can follow only the research and writings of about 150 to 200 other people. When the field gets larger than that, it splits into a subdiscipline. So this is a real challenge for those of us in any field, as we get sort of siloed in narrower and narrower, limited bunches of data and information that we can follow. Now, I see people manage more than 150. If you've got a good smart device, you've got a supportive spouse or life partner, you've got a good assistant, you're healthy, and people around you are like that too, you can manage more. Everybody, though, does hit a wall at some point. Now, based on my data, women are managing more connections, and for several reasons, and I think this is going to be intuitive for anybody who's listening. Children come with lots of connections. By the time a child is in the first grade, they can have 150 connections, and moms carry a lot of that management load. The data says, not just mine, but other data says disproportionately compared to dads. Pets also come with lots of connections, and 80% of pet care is done by women. Homeowners need a lot of people to help manage a home. And, you know, typical division of labor historically has been that women manage households and men manage an outside world. What's true even today among working women is that not only are they managing the external world, but they're managing the household instead. So there's that as well. And then finally, women are social connectors. And while I do think that there's evidence from that, I really see it in the data that I'm working with. And just two bits of information about that. Widowed men have told me that without a wife, they're not even seeing all of their family. One told me recently, it had been 4 years since his wife died. His daughter arranged for the entire family to be together for the first time since her mother's death. And it wasn't until he overheard his son telling his daughter, they're all now adults with kids of their own, thanks for getting us together. And that's when he realized. Older women also tell me they worry about their husbands. If they die first, they're concerned that their husbands will be instantly socially isolated, that they don't even, their husbands don't even invite their his own friends to the house, that it's the wife who has to suggest, why don't you have them over, you can watch the game and I'll make snacks. You know, so I think all of those are some of the reasons.
Very insightful on some of those examples that you just stated. So why does it seem that women struggle more with their networks than men?
First of all, I would say that all of us struggle because we don't have an awareness of all of the people in our networks and a language to even talk about it. So it's a kind of a noisy space in our minds. Now, in this regard, my observation is men have an advantage because they can compartmentalize better. So they can go to work and forget about home, for example, to a much greater degree than a woman can. In addition to that, relative to the question you asked me before, since a woman is more likely to be a caregiver, not only of children, but of older parents, including in-laws, when she gets to work, she'll be multitasking and doing caregiving tasks while she's on the job. I also think that men disconnect from bad connections more frequently than women do. In addition, I think women tend to step in and take over, even when they're not being asked to do so. They see a need and they do it. You know, if it's hungry, feed it. If it cries, cuddle it. I mean, I think that's a kind of an instinct. Probably one of the reasons why humanity's kept going is women tend to be good at stepping in situations in which there's a need. And I don't have good data about this yet. I hope to in the future. But I suspect that women have more direct reports at work than men of a similar rank. I hear women even bragging about it. And in one of my current business meetings, I was posing this question to one of my lawyers. He had been the general counsel for a very large healthcare company. And he said, well, yeah, there were 150 lawyers in my group, and the women did have more direct reports than men. And after all, everybody knows that women are better at managing people than men are. To which I replied to him, in other words, you are guaranteeing she is never going to go through the glass ceiling because she's spending all of her energy managing down, not up and not out. So I think those are some of the things that I see.
Those are very insightful, and I'm sure our audience can maybe sometimes relate to some of those examples that you just gave. So how do you plan to help others with Sage?
At Sage My Life, we have developed several things to help. One is a book that will be coming out very soon called The Network Sage. Subtitle is Realize Your Network Superpower, that walks through in great detail all the things that I've been talking about and gives people ideas about how they might think about their lives in a whole new way and what some people have done as a result of trying this out.
What are some differences that you're seeing with the gender usage on this tool?
Men tend to gravitate instantly towards their business. And at first, that's their first reaction. The second reaction is, I want my wife to have this too. The third is, if they have a daughter who's at least 15, they say, I want my daughter to have this because she is following in her mother's footsteps and she's focusing on everyone else, not herself. She needs to be getting ready for college and writing her essays and so on. And then finally, I wish women could see this about their husbands. Their husbands get this like faraway look in their eye and they say, you know, if my wife had this, we could have more fun. And what you almost see is this like dreamy return to romance. You know, like remember when it was just us before all of these people came flooding into their lives. Now, women, on the other hand, do look at all the networks. And as a result of that, women tend to experience more of what I call network crush, which is when you start looking at this this workload, it feels overwhelming. So everyone goes through this for a little while at the front end, which is why I've designed the software, is that I can get you past that in just a couple of minutes rather than what it would take if you didn't have that. Now, everyone who keeps going says it's worth the effort. But they have to get through that network crush part. The other thing that women see that they don't see beforehand is the load that they carry with regard to childcare. I was having a conversation with someone the other day. They're thinking about having a second child. And I referred to my niece and her husband who had the perfect first baby. This child slept through the night from the first day she was born. They thought, well, that was so easy. They'll have a second one. Well, as by all accounts, the second one is turning out to be even easier than the first. But these kids are only now hitting school. So it's only now that they're starting to appreciate the exponential number of people that come with a child. They didn't just add one person to their family. By first grade, they added 150 potentially new people that they were going to have to manage. That takes bandwidth, and women don't see that.
And it truly does take a village to raise a child, as we've kind of noted. Yeah. So maybe you can explain what those categories of networks are and what does it mean to have a support network in your life? Why does it matter? And maybe give some examples around that.
Yeah. It took me a number of years of experimenting to create these categories. I wanted something that made sense to me, but made sense to other people too. And here's what I've arrived at as a final. In all, as adults, we are supported by 8 networks. 5 of them I call birthright networks because you were born into them. Your parents created them for you. If you have children, you've created them for your children. And here's what they are. This is going to make total sense, pretty intuitive. First, a family network, not just your own family of origin, but your family today, maybe former family if you or your spouse or life partner were married before. And then people who are just like family. You know, you're not related by blood or marriage, but you consider them family. In today's world, we need some of those more than ever. Second, a health and vitality network. And that's all of the medical services you can think of, but also people who help you be fit and who help you look good. Because we know that appearance has a profound impact on how you feel, how other people relate to you, and even what your income will be. Attractive people make $250,000 more over the course of their lifetime than unattractive people. Third, your education and enrichment network. So school, things you do after school, and then things you do as a family to be enriched in some ways, museum tours and the arts and piano lessons and so on. Fourth, a spiritual network. And by that I mean not only a religious congregation, but for spiritual experiences outside of a formal religious congregation setting. For some people, that's walking in the woods. For some people, that's listening to music. For other people, it's poetry. Fifth, then, a social and community network. So your neighborhood, the clubs you're a part of, eventually social media. Now, when you enter adulthood, which, by the way, isn't an event, it's a process, and it takes place over a number of years, I say you acquire 3 additional networks. I call those coming-of-age networks. The first is a career network, and all the things we think about usually with networking. So I'm sure listeners are really familiar with this. People inside your company, outside your company, in your profession, you know, if you're a salesperson, the customers you have, the internal company support you have, and so on. Then you have a home, as a second coming-of-age network, a home and personal affairs network. So everything it takes to manage your household, and then personal affairs, things like your banker, your lawyer, your car dealer, you know, and so on. And then finally, you have a network I call Ghost. Now, in reality, this network has been growing from the start of your life. But it's really not until you start coming of age that you start thinking about these people. Ghosts are people who were once in your life who are no longer. What we know is everyone who comes into your life makes an impression on you, for better or not. And that can have a lasting impact. Now, the ones that make the better impression on you, I call friendly ghosts. You know, for me, it was a grandfather. I still remember how wonderful it was to sit in his lap, even though he died when I was 5 years old. The ones who left you with a bruise and a hole in your heart that you still ache from today, those I call hungry ghosts. I call them hungry because you couldn't satisfy them then and you can't satisfy them now, although chances are you're still trying. Not with them, of course, because they're not there, but with people or situations who remind you of them.
Very, very interesting on some of those insights around the different networks that we have in our life. I know that I have those hungry ghosts that play the broken record in the back of my brain that I have to constantly put on silence. So thank you for actually categorizing that name for me, because now I can finally stop that broken record and call it the lonely ghost that's hungry in the background. So
can I make one other comment about these networks?
Go for it.
So the first five networks that you have, your birthright networks, when you're old enough, and, you know, Mary, I know you have young children, they probably are already helping to shape those networks. They're giving you information about who a good babysitter is or who isn't. I mean, you know, I'm sure you're paying attention to that. So when you're young, you can start shaping those networks and the people in them. You will need what the people in those networks deliver to you forever. You can change these networks, they will evolve, but you will never outgrow your need for what those networks provided you as a child. And the same thing is true as an adult. So that's why it's important throughout the entire lifespan to understand that these networks of people provide really important value to you. That's the value, in part, of understanding what these networks are, and then making sure that you always have people in your life who are filling those roles.
I can't even express, like, thank you for actually drawing out these different categories, because as I'm going through this exercise, I'm thinking, okay, you know, I have my family network, I know who they are, my health and vitality network. I'm starting to think of, you know, who are those friends that help me keep fit and alive. And I think of my education and enrichment network, and I think of it kind of on almost two levels, where I have my children, and then I also have my adult friends who kind of help me as well engage that next level of learning, and the spiritual network and that social and community network, and really just kind of drawing and connecting those dots and starting to break it down to, hey, we truly do need these people. It does take a village to truly raise that child. So what are some of those big pitfalls that we make in with not understanding our networks? Maybe you can give us some insight there.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, you're going to miss opportunities. You won't see that there's help you already have in your network for something you need that's hiding in plain sight, because they're out of sight, they're out of mind. In addition to that, you can incur risks from mismanaging these networks. You'll risk spending your time in the wrong places. You'll risk your financial resources as well. You could risk your children. I know that when I'm talking to couples with young kids, a lot of them don't have custodial arrangements for their children in the event of their death. Now, the reason for that is that they don't want family to take custody. They want a friend to take custody, and they're afraid to confront that issue. As a result of that, they make their kids really vulnerable in the event they die and there are major disputes within a family about it. I'm going to make a kind of a bold statement, I think. If you're a woman with a career, and particularly if you have children and you have a household, you risk never being as successful as the men, because you're managing more than you realize without looking for help or better ways to do it. Even me as a single woman, looking back, I now realize that the biggest setback in my career came from owning a home. You know, my financial advisors talked to me about the money and what a good deal it would be in a tax break, and yes, I can afford it, so go for it. Some even encouraged me to buy homes that were much larger than I needed for those reasons. No one ever said, you have the bandwidth to manage 30 people, because that's what it takes. And you certainly can't walk away from your home if you've got a leak. And if you do, you don't go into a budget negotiation in your company or into a big meeting with a client with a clear head and peace of mind if you know that there's a problem in your property and that's the single largest investment you've made. If you have kids, you can put them at risk as well by not understanding that the people you allow into their lives are eventually hungry ghosts, and that can have a lasting impact on them. If you're a couple, and I've seen this happen, and it's really disastrous for the family, if you are probably sharing workload. So that means one of you knows something that the other does not, and it's important information. So I've seen young women die and leave husbands with no information, even as basic as what was the name of the children's pediatrician, or what were important school events that were coming up. And on the flip side, I know a man who died as the family was revising their will. They realized they hadn't done that since their third child was born, and he was 10. So the husband said he'd take care of it, and he was. But he was in Harrisburg on a business trip and dropped dead of a heart attack. The wife didn't know what lawyer he was talking to. And then if you're someone like me, I'm about to coin a new term, geographic orphan. I have family, but the nearest one is 1,000 miles away. So a couple of years ago, well into my working on this to become a network sage myself, my mom got sick. I navigated from 1,000 miles away with a telephone number for only one neighbor. Didn't know her doctor. And that's a mistake now that I've corrected. So now I have information about her. That was a harrowing experience, and I hear from people it's far more common than you might think.
I also think sometimes with a network, sometimes the biggest pitfall that I have is trying to get out safety information to, or updates about where their development is to all the caregivers that are in their life. So for instance, I know if for instance, an allergy comes up, being able to give that information to everybody in that network. So it's being able to understand, okay, who needs to have that. Just the other day, I forgot to tell my mother-in-law that my son is crawling. And so she forgot to close the door. So he crawled out the door. Everything is fine, but it's just sometimes it's one of those areas where our communication can always improve. To jump into a couple other questions. So why do we have such a hard time delegating? And what are some steps that our audience can do to start delegating?
Okay. Let me start with your first question, which is about why. I've seen a variety of reasons. Some people don't have role models. You know, their parents did everything around the house, and that might have been easy if their mother was not in the workforce. But now, even though they're in the workforce, they feel like they don't even consider delegating. It's just not a model they've seen happen. Some have very high standards, even about how the beds are made. And so they think either I'm going to have to redo it, or why not do it myself the first time around. Some have trouble holding other people accountable and dealing with any conflicts that can result. And often that happens just because they're plain too tired. So it's easier to do it yourself. You avoid a conflict or facing somebody who hasn't done a job well that you've got to deal with. And let's face it, sometimes it is easier to do it yourself. And I'll kind of return to that when I talk about some things that I did. And then sometimes your connections, the people you live with or you know, don't support your delegating. So a little bit about what I did. I took that list of 139 people and I divided it into two parts. One part was a list of everything I did not personally need to do. The other part was. So for example, if my clothes are going to be altered, I have to show up at the tailor. But I don't have to take my clothes to the dry cleaners, and I don't have to pick them up, and don't have to stand in lines at post offices, and I don't have to go to the grocery store. I can get somebody to do that for me. So bundling tasks and delegating is an easier way to do it. It doesn't help to delegate 10 tasks to 8 different people. But if you can bundle 8 tasks and give them to one person, that makes it a lot easier. Now, by the way, that's what I did in hiring a community college student to work a couple of hours a week on a flex time basis to run these errands for me. I thought I was being pretty smart and to figure that out because I had no role model for delegating tasks like that. And I thought I was being rather generous to give somebody who was at a community college that was nearby the chance to make some extra money. But I did have friends who were very critical of my doing so. said that I was being elitist, and in fact, I write about this in my book, but my friends suggested that I not include it in the book and that I not talk about it because I was likely to be criticized as a result.
Very interesting. What are some actions our audience can take to better understand their networks? Is there a way we can start to classify our networks or a way we can begin to focus on certain individuals?
Yes, there's a couple things you can do. Even before my book is available with more detail about this. And the first would be to go back to the blog that accompanies this podcast, where we'll include a list of all of those networks. So if anybody's driving right now, they don't have to worry. We'll have those there. Using that list, they can then start to develop their own list. And even in the absence of my software, they can do it on paper. People who do that say it's still a worthwhile thing to do, even though it takes a little bit longer. Then, once you have that list of people, note next to everyone's name just how important they are to you. You know, if they cut off the connection with you, if they died, would you be devastated? That means they're very important. That would be your spouse or life partner, your kids, maybe your pet, your parents, your boss, your best clients, people like that. Then make a note of all of those who are providing you with services, doctors, dentists, lawyers, hairdressers, manicurists, people who cut your grass, shovel your snow, all of those people. And from that list, then start asking yourself questions. First of all, is somebody missing? Do you have a lawyer? If you don't have a lawyer, you may be among the 70% of Americans who don't have an up-to-date will. So make a note for yourself about that. Then look at what's working for you and what's not. I'll give you one example. A woman who decided that her internist wouldn't do a pap smear and her gynecologist would only do a pap smear and check her blood pressure. So she found a family physician who would do both. So for herself, she went from managing two medical practices and two visits a year to one. And to some people, that might not seem like a lot, but those of us who are busy and overloaded know that's a relief, is to have only one medical office. This woman had three children. She transferred her children's care from the pediatrician to the family physician's office. So now she went from, in a very short time, from managing three medical offices to managing one. Now she's trying to get her husband to move his practice over there too. So look for ways that you can become more efficient and get what you want in that way, including bundling some things and delegating a bunch of tasks out to one person if that's possible for us.
Excellent. And so where can they find you, Glenna?
One is the Network Sage blog, which will be posted on sagemylife.com or glennacrooks.com. My book, The Network Sage, Realize Your Network Superpower, will be released at the end of third quarter, or early fourth quarter 2017. And I have a follow-up book, which is a workbook called The Senior Sage, Age Well in Place Workbook, to be released soon after that. My email address is glenna@glennacrooks.com, which would be the preferred way to reach me by email.
So with that, I want to thank our listeners for taking the time of listening to us. And, you know, tell us what you think by leaving us a comment below and visiting us on Invadology for all these show notes and more. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening to the Invadology podcast. We hope we have generated some disruptive ideas and helped unleash that creative side. Please help us keep innovating and leave us a comment or a review on our website. Till next time, don't stop innovating.